Good afternoon or evening, whenever this finds you, or good morning, I guess, for that matter. It is June 19th, 2026, Friday, and I wasn't really planning on making a video today. I'm going to start by saying that most of this video is going to be talking about how the Trump administration, at least on the surface, is showing an enormous amount of courage. And I want to get into what that's all about, but I also, before I get too far into this video, and I'm going to try and make it a short one, I want to talk about why I'm here. I got an email today, and I'm only going to change names and a couple things about it, but I thought it was great. Really moving, meaningful. I've been listening to you for a few months now. I appreciate your thoughts and the work you must constantly do. So today I finally decided to subscribe, which is something I never do anywhere. I have no social media. My phone has everything shut off except the actual things a phone should be used for. My computer was built by a friend 14 years ago who has since passed. Anyway, my name is so-and-so. I'm advanced in age, and I am alone in this world. I do jigsaw puzzles of the faces of beautiful women while I listen to you. And my sincere wish is that you would be our prime minister. Even though I do not always agree with your viewpoint, I do, however, understand why you do not have that goal in mind. The main thing is that a person is honest, and you have an uncanny ability to always project that. I like you, sir. So for that reason, I'm sending you this email to tell you that the subscribe button does not work for me. Now, the subscribe button will not work if you don't have an account with Google. I don't blame anybody for doing that, and I mean, subscriptions, it's not important. Your time's more important to me. The thing that really got me about this is not that he says he wants me to be prime minister. Everybody that ever says that, it's just a curse. I mean, you want to give me work. It was the idea that somebody alone in this world, as self-described, doing jigsaw puzzles of beautiful women's faces, listens to me. And that helps break the loneliness, or at least fill in the spaces. You know, I'm always talking about motivation for continuing and feeling like I'm making an impact, or these themes of like, what's it all about, right? And you know, I get a few emails from people talking about various reasons why they watch, and I appreciate all of them, but that line, that idea of being a voice in the loneliness, a voice that helps in that moment, that space, that was really quite impactful and entirely the reason I am here filming this right now. And I'm not going to talk more about that. We'll get on to the subject matter of what this video is all about. And I want to talk about how it takes tremendous courage, whether you like it or not, whether you like what's been done or not, to even if not admit you made a mistake, you admit you made the mistake by the actions that you're taking and by the change in your trajectory. So I said this about Scott Moe when I first moved here, because Saskatchewan was one of the first places in the country to lift the mandates. It was one of the least... I'm not trying to whitewash what happened here in Saskatchewan, but it was one of the least draconian places. In a lot of areas of this province during the 2021 thing, life carried on fairly normally. And the Saskatchewan legislature made the mistake of locking people down. They did the same things that everybody else did. They might have done it with a lighter hand, but they were just as guilty. However, the legislature took the step of listening, which was very courageous, listening to Robert Malone and voices from the other side. Just before I moved here, they did that. I remember one of the last things that I was monitoring in Ontario was the developments that were happening in Saskatchewan, and I had some private connections here that enabled me to see beyond what you see on the surface in terms of the news media. I knew what the legislature was up to, and they were listening to the other voices. And then they lifted. They lifted the lockdowns. They lifted the mandates. They were among the first to do so. And by the time I moved here, it was all gone and everybody was basically living their lives like normal. It wasn't like Ontario where the mandates lifted and the majority of people were still in their masks and paranoid. People in Saskatchewan had moved on before the mandates were lifted, but people have often said, and they're correct, the Saskatchewan government's never come out and apologized for the damage it did to people. Just like any other government in this province, or sorry, in the country, never publicly apologized for the damage they did, except for the Smith government. I think they were the closest to that. But they changed their trajectory, they changed their policies, and if you read between the lines, you can understand that it was understood. You can understand that it was understood. You can understand that what they were saying was that they made a mistake. And you didn't get that public apology, okay? And this isn't to carry water for the Sask party government. We just had an election a year and a half ago, I believe it was. And they made a bunch of promises that they haven't kept yet. And we should keep at them. You should never be dialed into a political team and feel that that's the only thing you can do. You should never be afraid to criticize your party or a party. We don't need more uncritical media. I mean, that's what we got with the mainstream media. I mean, it's all the big red machine. It's all back in the Liberal Party. But in the alternative media space, so much of it will not criticize the Conservative Party of Canada, will not criticize their direction, will not criticize the state of Israel. They lack courage, just like CBC. They have less money and they have less reach. They have less resource than the CBC, which just lost Hockey Night in Canada, is going to replace it with a bunch of pride-themed, ethnically diverse programming that nobody's going to watch. Anyway, that's a whole other story. I want to focus on the fact that it takes courage for any politician to change directions. And Trump has done the equivalent of a 180 this week in a very short amount of time when it comes to Iran as an independent nation. When it comes to, I mean, let me just play a clip quick.
In relative proportion, I think.
Yeah. You said in the press conference, you said you don't mind Iran having ballistic missiles. Can you elaborate on that? I want to make sure we understand your position.
No, I'm saying that if other countries have them, it's a little bit unfair for them not to have some. A ballistic missile is not the same thing as what we're talking about when we talk nuclear. But if Saudi Arabia and Qatar and they all have some, I would say in relative proportion, I think it's okay. That's what I'm saying.
He left out one state. Israel has all kinds of ballistic missiles. They have nuclear missiles. Everybody knows it, but nobody will publicly acknowledge it. But it's interesting that the president went from no ballistic missile program whatsoever to, well, if other people have them, Iran has a right to have them too. The fact is the Americans lack the power to take them away from the Iranians. And that's what this war proved. The war was a mistake. I'll maintain that forever. There are people out there who say, oh, Frank, you just don't understand. This was Trump checkmating Lloyd's of London. The insurance racket. People think Lloyd's has a monopoly on commercial maritime insurance. They are 10% of the market. They've been at it for 300 years, but they're 10% of the commercial maritime insurance market. And they will still be insuring boats in the Persian Gulf when this is all said and done. This is that Promethean action talking point. This is this, what I would consider nonsense, which is inventing these narratives to try and essentially just try to shoehorn and squeeze everything into a nice tidy box that prevents you from seeing what actually happened, and is that the American government is deeply infiltrated by Israeli interests. And that led America into a strategic defeat in the Middle East. This is the end of the American dominance of the Middle East, or American influence in the Middle East. And that's a good thing. You see, Donald Trump, the man who talked before he became president again, the man who talked before he became president the first time, he knows these things. He's publicly stated them. He went before a Republican presidential debate with sharing the stage with some absurd number. It was like over a dozen people on the stage. Every single one of them, except Donald Trump, thought that George W. Bush was a hero. that the Iraq war was amazing. And he went out there and he said, no, Bush failed to protect us in 2001. He's no hero. And trillions of dollars and thousands of lives were lost in Iraq. And for what? For nothing. And he was booed. If they had tomatoes, they would have been throwing them at him. Everywhere he went, he was attacked. And that's where he won a lot of my respect, was in those days. I genuinely think he believes those things. It doesn't mean that he is not constrained by the realities of politics and influence and money and the things that happen in politics. He believes that. He knows that. And he knows that it's time for the American empire abroad to come home, whether it's getting out of NATO, which he's talked about extensively. That's the right move. If the European nations, who have invaded Russia 6 times, while Russia has not invaded Europe ever, I mean, you can argue that World War II was an invasion. They did some horrible things behind the Iron Curtain. But, digressing, it was Napoleon that went into Russia. It's been Europe that's gone into Russia. It's just a weird thing. But if they want to continue this multi-century battle that they've had with the Russians, which the Russians have the energy that Europe needs, it's a relationship. Russia's part of Europe. I cannot understand why people work in their own economic disinterest. They work against their own prosperity. Russia has everything the Europeans need. They're right beside each other. They're a match made in heaven, and it's always been that way. Even the Germans before Barbarossa understood that Russian energy and Russian material was critical to the German war machine, which was why they were doing business with them. And if Hitler had not invaded in 1941, he and Stalin would have been doing business for years to come. It's actually probably a good thing that he did, because we'd all be speaking German now if he hadn't have. Hubris is a bitch. It comes and gets us all. Forgive my language. But at any rate, the idea is, it takes courage to change your mind and change your trajectory. And I would call what happened this week, if it sticks, if it's not just some ploy, thinking ahead, because 4 weeks away from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve being empty, the economic catastrophe on the horizon, elements of which we will still have to suffer, this deal and a cessation of hostilities and a reopening of the Persian Gulf isn't going to fix the problem that's already baked in, but it will limit further damage. It's a really smart move by the Trump administration to get out of this thing. And I have to applaud that. I wanted to highlight J.D. Vance in his comments. This was a day or two ago, I believe. Vance pointed to criticism of the deal from Israeli officials, including far-right minister Bezalel Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gvir. And I guess my response to them would be, what is your exact proposal? You're a country of 9 million people. You can't just kill your way out of solving every single national security problem that you have. Some pretty powerful words from an American vice president. You could argue hypocritical, but... And I mean not hypocritical in terms of this administration, who I think you can make a case has killed a lot less people than previous administrations so far, including the Obamas and the Bushes and the Clintons, but we'll leave it where it is right now. He called on Israel to let negotiations play out and to give a little bit of credit to the United States of America. Do you think? Maybe? You can't just kill your... Which I think has been an incredible partner for the Israeli government for a long time. The two wars, or the two chapters of the war from last June and now, has cost the American taxpayer probably $100 billion when you factor in everything, far more than the Israeli budget for national defense. I believe the United States largely abandoned its Gulf cooperation country allies to dedicate resources to the defense of Israel. The Trump administration has invoked the Defense Production Act as U.S. moves to rebuild weapon stockpile. You know, you keep hearing this talking point about Donald Trump, and I'm not here to pretend that Donald Trump is perfect. That's not my job. It's not my function, you know. But he talks about how he rebuilt the military. It's the talking point, but you don't just rebuild a military by signing an executive order. It's something that takes decades. or could take a decade, 5-10 years to actually get things up to speed the way the United States and the pace with which they build these weapons to replenish their stockpiles. Well, again, back to the United States being an excellent friend to Israel, they depleted most of their high-tech munitions, and now the United States is less of a threat to its geopolitical adversaries around the world. Sure, they have nuclear weapons, but so does Israel, so does Russia, so does China, so does Pakistan. For those people who say, an Islamic country cannot have nuclear weapons, I'm sorry, Pakistan already did that. They got the t-shirts. I don't really know what you're talking about. There's a guy that keeps commenting all the time. He's like, well, at least we got the nuclear weapons out of Iran. I'm like, bro, they didn't have nuclear weapons. They didn't want nuclear weapons. Like, how are you repeating that talking point at this stage in the game? When U.S. intelligence summarized, Tulsi Gabbard summarized, who, by the way, she on her way out the door on her last day, Gabbard drops Fauci COVID-19 receipts on last day. He funded the research, cooked the cover story, then lied to Congress. We were right about everything. We were right. None of us have had anybody reach out to us and apologize over what they did to us in 21 and into 22 and even in 2020. The censorship, the ostracization, the family members that made you do rapid tests just to be around them. Those of us who complied with that, I certainly never did. Never had a COVID test once because I knew if I got a positive test, I knew how inaccurate the things were. And I knew if I got a positive test, there goes all my rights. What right? There goes all my privileges. Better word, we don't have rights in Canada. We have privileges. Sometimes. Turns out we were right about everything. Now it's going to be interesting. Will Fauci go to jail? Will he be charged? Will he be brought up on contempt of Congress like charges? Will there be any judicial process to seek justice, restitution for the public that he helped destroy? We'll see. I'm not going to hold my breath for that. But, you know, I did want to read back to the point when it comes to Israel, because the key to holding this, I don't even want to call it a peace. I think the desire to end the war is beyond genuine for the United States. You read that 14-point memorandum, Iran gets way more out of it than anyone else does. And they're the ones getting reparations, which reparations don't go to the losing sides in war. Now, people will say, well, we did the Marshall Plan. Europe was rebuilt in World War I and World War II. It's not the same thing. That's not reparations. That's a reconstruction plan, especially when we're talking about World War II, so tens of millions of people didn't die of starvation, which many did die of starvation after the war ended. Like the story of Europe from 45 to 55, there's got to be a book out there on it. Like, I want to read a book on that. I know enough about it from what I've read and gleaned, but in terms of literature, it's kind of this don't look here chunk of time. It's almost like a mini dark age. And I think it's because it was such a dire situation in Europe, but I digress. What I wanted to highlight was a couple quotes from Israel. First off, they're not intending to leave southern Lebanon. They might have agreed that a U.S. official said that Hezbollah and Israel have agreed to stop hostilities today in honor of the ceasefire. I don't know if that's enough for the Iranians. I don't think it doesn't satisfy the MOU. And we don't really know if they're going to do it because we're relying on a U.S. official. And Israel's killed 47 people since midnight. Since midnight. You know, at the very beginning of this, I was called an anti-Semite for suggesting that the Israelis didn't need to knock down residential towers every time they wanted to kill a militant. Well, that's what the president is saying now. That's what the vice president is saying now. So I'm not sure how you square that circle. And the anti-Semitism thing, it's really weak. It's outlived its prime. I've never understood why, as a Canadian, or as an American, or as a Brit, or as a Frenchman, why are we shamed into silence about criticizing the Israeli state, which does a lot of bad things, are doing ethnic cleansing right now. That's exactly what it is. Look up the definition of what ethnic cleansing is. It fits the bill in Gaza, and it certainly fits the bill in Lebanon. Not quite it fits the bill in the West Bank, too. I had some doubts. I mean, it's about how far you go. I think they're there on every single front. It's what they're doing. And it's a shame. And the idea that we should be silenced by the label of anti-Semitism every time we criticize the state of Israel, it's, first off, it's weak. It's completely inaccurate. And every time they do it, it gets less and less meaningful. And now I guess the president's an anti-Semite. In spite of all of the help the Americans have given, in spite of all the help the American taxpayer gives and continues to give to the Israeli state, somehow the president is being questioned as an anti-Semite. But the Israeli defense minister said this. This is a member of Netanyahu's government. And keep in mind that the opposition is very critical of Netanyahu right now. They want, the opposition in Israel wants more. One of the things I've said recently, I would say in the last month or two, that I have to update my worldview on is that I don't know if I ever said the majority of the Israeli public opposes this idea of territorial expansion. I don't think I ever said that, but I feel like I overestimated how much opposition there actually is in Israeli society to the conquest of Gaza and Lebanon. It's like 2/3 of the people love it and want more of it. And I would say probably another 1/5 to 2/5 of the society is indifferent. And then there's probably 1 million people, 1.5 million, 2 million, maybe as high as 3 million people that actually oppose it in some way. And we shouldn't dismiss them. It's not a universally held opinion, but it's very popular. The Israeli opposition wants harsher, more war. There's an election coming up in October. And within Netanyahu's government, there's voices like the defense minister who said, this is the quote, "We have flattened the entire first line of villages in South Lebanon. All the houses have been destroyed. The residents will never see them standing ever again. The 200,000 Lebanese residents who were in the security zone are never returning. Not one of them will ever return to southern Lebanon." That is ethnic cleansing, the definition of it. The Israelis are the only people engaged in ethnic cleansing on this scale on earth. And it's time people said so, because things are way out of control. This isn't 2022 anymore. Israel has entered new realms. The national security minister said, "For every tear of an Israeli mother, 1,000 Lebanese mothers must weep. All of Lebanon must burn." Who are these people? Demons. Demons. And these are the people in the government. The people that the Israeli opposition is saying aren't going far enough. That's a dark situation. So, all that is to say that it remains to be seen whether or not the Trump administration can actually effectively rein the Israelis in a lasting way. Because political expediency, the fact that there's an election coming in October in Israel, is one consideration. Netanyahu can afford to pause right now. His corruption investigation in the trial could resume and theoretically be broken later by another incident of armed conflict. Could potentially save him in an election if he can. You got to give Netanyahu credit. You really do. This is a political survivor. He has been prime minister for 20-odd years, spanned, I think it's 20 years exactly, actually, but spanned over a much larger period of time. This guy was prime minister back in the 90s when I was, like, young. I remember his name. He's a survivor. He's very shrewd. So if anybody in politics can take the next 3 months and somehow thread a needle of trying to stop and then restart a war, it's him, for political reasons. His survival counts on it. So that's one layer of disruption. But the Americans, they, and the Trump administration specifically, and the Republican Party, are coming up on a very contentious election. People will spin it and say it's not contentious at all. It is contentious. the Democrat Party might still be a bastion of extremist ideology, but it doesn't really matter to an electorate that's just looking to tap the brakes on the Trump administration, which is what they're doing now. They have to try and salvage the economy enough to win the midterms, because if the midterms are lost, Trump might as well just resign, because he's going to be boxed in. I think he knows it. And I think that explains why after the USC fight, he gets on a plane, he goes to France, and everybody says, he's tired because he was up partying the night before. Man, I've never heard Trump sound worse. His voice was hoarse. It was crackly. His suit looked frumpy. He looked heavy. He looked defeated. And it didn't make me feel good. You know, I didn't like seeing it. Believe it or not, I have a soft spot for at least the ideas and the image that he projects. I don't understand the Epstein stuff, and I think I really hope that comes back to the fore. We need to see more of it. We need to understand why, because it may not be Trump. It may be something else in the process. Why did Bongino cover it up? Why did Bondi cover it up? Why Cash Patel? Why did everybody gaslight the living hell out of the electorate over it? And some people say the answer is obvious. Trump is guilty. I don't know if that's the case. I don't know what it is. None of us know what it is. That's the problem. All I know is nobody's been charged for the trafficking of minors, and that is a tragedy that I personally can never forget or condone. And we'll see what happens. But there's a confluence of political circumstances coming together and economic circumstances that affect those political circumstances that dictate an attempt to try and stop this thing at any cost. That's why the Americans gave everything up in the MOU. They gave it up, man. It's a conditional surrender document. And I don't know how anybody can spin it as a victory. I see people do that. Jack Posobiec spinning it as the greatest victory. That idiot in Ontario, Zachary Tisdale, I don't know. He needs to give his brain a shake. And when I say the word idiot, I want you to understand idiocy has a cure. Information can fix it. I don't say it vainly. I mean, it takes a lot of, it takes a certain talent of willful ignorance to be able to look at that MOU and read those points and come to the conclusion that it is a win for the United States and it is net positive for the United States. I think it's an admission that further warfare would be catastrophic, that the Americans have been strategically defeated in the region. They may, and I mean, geopolitics is an interesting thing. There's a chance the United States could recover some, I wouldn't say all, of their influence and power in the region. I don't think they want to. I don't think Donald Trump wants to. I think Trump knows he's got to come home. America's power's here. This is a thing, man. You know, people want to talk about comparisons to maybe the British Empire falling apart. It's not the same thing. The British didn't have an empire to lose. They had an empire overseas. There ain't much going on in the British Isles. If you look at North America, if you look at the United States, we got everything we need right here. We have an empire. North America doesn't need an empire overseas. We possess it already. There's a fairly large population here. We don't need it to be much bigger. If you can't get the job done of defending a continent with 480 million souls, I'm not sure you can get it in an age of ballistic missiles, drones, and nuclear weapons. I'm not sure you can get the job done. We don't need the old world's problems. We have an empire already, right here. And everybody should be coming home. And that includes Mark Carney in Canada and everything that's going on in Canada. We got to come home. Europe doesn't have our answers. China doesn't have our answers. They don't have our interests at heart, and they shouldn't. They're there. We're here. And God knows, you know, you look at the United States, You look at their infrastructure. You look at their bridges. You look at the roads in many places. Now, of course, there's going to be exceptions. It's falling apart. There's a dozen great YouTube channels where it's just guys who go driving around in towns all over the United States and film what they see. It's bad. America needs that money. It needs that attention. It needs that time. It needs that resources. It needs to reorganize and rebuild and focus on Fortress North America. It's the only idea in town. It's the only good idea out there. Everything else is just window dressing or trying to hang on to something that's already gone. It's been gone for a long time, or it's been going for a long time. And this war in the Middle East is an example of that. This is like the resurrection of the neocon era, the John Brzezinskis and the George H.W. Bushes and the Dick Cheneys and the Rumsfelds and the Colin Powells and the Mike Pompeos. Resurrected for one last hurrah to spend a bunch of time and treasure and lose a bunch of lives in the Middle East for nothing. For nothing. For something you can't hold on to. And there are a lot of talking points now that the Democrats are armed with. They're absolutely true. What was it all for? Why did hundreds of service members die and get injured? Died or injured. What did they win? What did all that treasure win? And it won nothing. It was a defeat. And they've got that talking point now. The one thing the Republicans and the Trump administration has going for it, the public mind is a sieve. Short-term memory is, I should say long-term, medium-term. Medium-term, long-term memory is not very good. Short-term memory is about all we can expect. And maybe there's enough time between now and then to heal it, to secure the elections, to get the vote, and maybe they can hang on. But I honestly, I don't really care about the outcome. I'm looking at it from their perspective. I'm more interested in just trying to call the shots and figure out what actually is. You know what I mean? Like, I don't really want to be on a team. I really like the idea, and I find it incredibly meaningful. The way that it came across with that email that I read of someone alone doing puzzles, listening to me to help fill that space. That is one of the greatest compliments anybody's ever paid me in my life. And that's what I'm concerned with. And you know, I'll finish on this note. Not this. This is, we don't need to talk about that today. Where is it? Yeah. So I listen to depositions a lot. I study cults. I study personalities. I finally gotten around to this guy, David E. Taylor, the apostle. He's in a federal prison in the United States right now. Basically declared himself Messiah. Not quite, but he might as well have. And this is a YouTube channel called Full Frontal Investigation. I just found them the other night. And they did this fantastic documentary. And it's not just about David E. Taylor. It's also about Jimmy Jones, Benny Hinn, David Koresh. And it's just a comparative study. And tells the story of how these cults actually happen and their characteristics and provides a lot of details, you know. And one of the things that I've learned, because as much as I've listened to some more of the popularized, I guess, speeches by Jim Jones. The guy started as a pastor or as a bishop or whatever the heck he called himself. An apostate of Christ. And by the end, he had declared himself God the Father himself while telling his people there was no God. The only God was humans. And the true religion that was truly going to reach deity was socialism, and that he was a socialist messiah. I was blown away, and that sent me down a rabbit hole of even further study of Jim Jones. These people had the power over people, to demand that they empty their bank accounts, to demand that they lay down their lives, to demand that they drink Kool-Aid. And it's not isolated. Stuff like this stuff is still going on in Saskatchewan today. I'm not saying they're all bad, but like some of these personality evangelical cults, the Ken Copelands, which I mean is not Saskatchewan, I'm just saying it's local to Saskatchewan, they come here too. The Ken Copelands of the world, they're still out there. They're still doing this. And there are humans lining up in droves to participate. It almost appears, after listening to hours and hours and hours of depositions and staying up way later and then getting up early to keep resuming it, of different situations like this, the one thing that I can guarantee anyone listening is I ain't trying to set up a cult. I won't be trying to set up a cult. I will never take unfair advantage of you. And I consider it an honor that anyone chooses to listen to what I have to say any day. I value every second of your time. Anyway, this video is dedicated to the guy who wrote that email. I'm Frank Vaughn. I'll see you in the next one.